You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. Join me as we uncover the rich histories of North America's Great Plains, exploring the latest archaeological discoveries and past cultures that shaped this storied region. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. I'm your host, Professor Carlton Shield Chief Cover, and we're thrilled and excited to have you join me on this journey through the rich and fascinating history of North America's Great Plains. I'm really excited tonight. We have a guest, Aaron Bryan. Aaron is the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Crow Nation up in Montana on Crow Agency. Aaron, it is a pleasure to have you on. This is the first time I think I've seen your face. We've chatted before a while ago at the early onset of COVID and have remained off and on in touch. So it's a real pleasure to have you on tonight.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I don't often. Usually it's my face people see first. And then, so that's new. But yeah, it always seemed like our circles are, we were kind of like orbiting each other, you know, and kind of in the same vein, I guess. And so, yeah, so it's good something like this can happen.
Absolutely. And we just started recently re-talking because you have your own podcast and you were talking about trying to get a hold of Elizabeth Weiss. And I was just like, oh, that's a spicy hot take. Like, I wonder what Aaron has planned for that.
Yeah, I still want to do that. I'm still working on my email. I want it to be right, you know?
Right. That's an important one to get it right. And so I want to start off, like, we've been having a couple tippos on the show. So, and we'll talk more about your tippo work more later. But as I was like gearing up for the episode, I found like an interview, an article that you were like interviewed for talking about, in which you were talking a lot about your grandmother and a lot of the knowledge that your grandmother was talking to you. And so like that idea of like storytelling really, really, I really connected with, and something I don't think we've really talked about on this podcast quite yet. So I really just wanted to start off like, you know, what were those experiences of as a young man listening to your grandmother's stories about Crow history, Crow people, and your culture?
Well, they've become the most important things, you know, some of the most important memories of my life. I'm pretty fortunate to have known all my grandparents, you know, my dad's parents, my mom's parents, and even knew my great-grandfather on my mom's side and his sisters. So I was pretty fortunate to like be around them and to learn from them and just soak it all in, not fully knowing, you know, what those things were or what they were going to be or how it would play out later, you know. But I'm still pretty blessed, man. My grandmother's still alive. She's 91 years old and she lives right here in Crow Agency. And I see her fairly regular. My sister is her primary caregiver now, but she's still coherent. She still tells stories and I'm still learning from her when I can. And so it's hard to explain. Like, there's the obvious thing, right? You learn the stories, people tell you stories, you learn those stories. But really, there's things that happen in the Crow language, there's things that happen in Crow landscape that are like encoded inside these stories. And it's like my job to mine them, right? Like I go in there and I find them. And to me, that's what indigenous archaeology is. It has nothing to do with really archaeology as the discipline. It's being able to find those things within the most important thing in our culture, which is our oral history. It's how everything happens. It's how everything functions. So I learned that from my grandmother and her explanation of things and dissecting those topics, whatever it is we're talking about, you know?
So. Absolutely. And like, that's a really important point that you mentioned about, you know, indigenous archaeology is more than, you know, people, when they think of indigenous archaeology, even like tribal citizens or like my family, they think it's just, oh, Carlton goes and digs things up. And it's like, no, it's kind of beyond that. It is that idea of investigating or looking at our oral traditions, our stories, or these landscapes in a different lens that we often tie back to the archaeological record, but doesn't necessarily mean active digging or new excavations. It is being able to synthesize the archaeological discipline, but also look at our own stories in a different light to see how braided those things truly are conceptually.
Yeah, and as you know, most archaeology, most of the time we're not digging. That's something we're not doing, I guess. And so when I was in doing my education, and especially in graduate school, I really abandoned like a lot of archaeology, like I abandoned it. I tried it and I got kind of scolded by my grandmother's cousin And he actually passed away this year. But he said, why are you trying to change? You know, you already know what you're doing. Just do that. And I thought, why? I mean, he's right. Like, I was trying to do what I was taught, you know, and really, I just needed to be who I am, you know, so and that was it. And he's right. Changed everything. So I wrote my thesis on the archaeology of fasting, like vision quests, culture. But it was really just an oral history with some archaeology attached to it. And I mean, and then everything I've published since is really just that. It's just crow stuff that involves things. You know, I don't get caught up in that kind of stuff, you know.
Absolutely. For the audience, where did you do your undergrad and graduate school?
I did at the same place at the University of Montana, but I got an associate's degree at Salish Kootenai College on the Flathead Reservation, which actually was the hardest degree I got. So my undergrad is in Native American Studies and Anthropology, and it's kind of leaning towards like cultural anthropology. And then I got my master's in archaeology or in anthropology, but I really focused on archaeology and like cultural resource management. Like that was kind of my thing, was like management issues and cultural heritage, you know. But my diploma itself will just, it's just a general degree in anthropology, general master's degree in anthropology. So.
Gotcha. Absolutely. And so like, you know, even thinking about what you're talking about with your thesis, right, that we can look at, you know, oral traditions are a way for us to connect the past with the present, right? But then like using the archaeology thesis and the archaeological work is tying the present back to the past, almost in that circular motion, right? Of being informed by the traditions of the past, those stories told to us by our grandparents, our uncles, aunts that are taught to them by their grandparents, uncles, aunts, and then taking that information and respecting it in a way to then bring it full circle. Am I making any sense, or am I like Charlie Day from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia?
No. Well, he's cool too, so. I'd listen. Yeah. No, you're making sense. I think what my goal has always been, and in any of this work, whether it's scholarship or preservation, is I've always wanted to be matter of fact, right? So my approach to anthropology and my approach to studying my own people has always been that I try to be matter of fact. So the idea that I don't call fasting vision quest is simply because that's not what it is. You know, like it had nothing to do with a theory. It had nothing to do with like an approach, a philosophy behind it. It just was really, well, in the Crow language, they say Bilashisan or Alakhaba, which means to go without water, where they made a bed and went without water. That's it. Doesn't say nothing about looking for a dream or a vision or anything. That might be the result of it, but what is it actually called? It's just Alakhaba, where they made a bed. That's it. So to me, that's not a philosophy. That's not like it doesn't take an NSF grant to do that, to just say, well, let's right the wrong. Is it a vision quest or a fasting bed? It's a fasting bed. And you would have thought for some of these people, I reinvented the wheel, like the way they were coming at this. So it's like, I'm not trying to be poetic. I'm not trying to be prophetic. I just try not to deviate from the knowledge, you know?
Absolutely. That's been a theme when I talk to other Native folks in archaeology, when they're just like taking what has been told to them and what they know in their culture with their people and just looking at something in the archaeological record, like, well, that's just what it is. Like that is its function. That is the noun. Yeah. And like, you don't have to attach these other abstract ideas that some archaeologists get worked up about. It's just like, no, I mean, like, and there's always that case study that's taught a lot in like intro to archaeology courses of like those archaeologists working in the Italian Alps, and they find some hexagonal looking thing and have no idea what it is, show it to the people in town, and a grandmother knows, a Nona knows exactly what it is, and it's a little thing for making mittens. And it's like, of course, that's, you know, if you're some archaeologist trained out of Rome who's never left Rome and has never had to wear mittens, and you go up to a subalpine region where the Romans had a fort, you're not going to know what these old ways of making mittens are. So, I mean, it's that same idea of when Native people get involved in this field and know the record because it's their people that created it and still continue to make that today, it's easier for us to recognize that material culture and be like, well, that's just what it is. And here's our word for it in our language because it is within our sphere. So just always awesome. And I think we like, I got so excited to talk to you about your work without, like, who, Aaron, who are the Crow people? Like, who are your people? Like, what's awesome about them? Where are you guys from? Where are homelands at? Because I don't think we've ever talked about Crows on the Crow people on this podcast. And what is the name for the Crow people in your guys' language?
We're known as the Apsaluga people, but our real name is Biluga. Biluga means our side. And there's three groups. There's the, what they call the kicked in the billies. Their other name is Lodge on the Edge. And then there's the mini lodges, which are in the literature is written as mountain crows all the time. You always hear mountain crow. And then river crows, their name is the Black Lodges. And so those are the three major bands of the Crow. And our area really is most of Montana and Wyoming, part of northern Colorado and into Saskatchewan and Alberta and North and South Dakota. But I guess what we're known for is the Yellowstone River, the Bighorn River, the Little Bighorn River, the Powder River, the Tongue, the Three Forks of the Missouri, and then the Missouri itself. You know, that's kind of like what we're known for. But at any given time, any number of people from any one of those groups can be in or around that region. But our centerpiece to who we are is the Bighorn Mountains, the Clouds Peak. We're called Plains Indians. We're categorized as Plains Indians, but really we're like a straddle. We kind of straddle the continental divide in the mountains and the Rockies in the front, the eastern front of the Rockies. And so we relate a lot to like the Blackfeet and the Flatheads, the Salish people, the Shoshone, the Nez Perce. So we're kind of culturally are tied in with them, as well as like the Lakota and even into like the Omahas and like the Pawnee, you know, and like there's some connections there to the Kiowa. And so we're kind of like, I don't want to say an in-between people, but because of our territory and where we lie, where we sit, we're right between like the Missouri River trade routes and the Columbia River trade routes. And so we got,
yeah, you guys are like at the end, you're the last stop on the Missouri River Trade Center, but also, mm-hmm. like you said, like on that interface with like the Great Basin folks and the Rocky Mountain folks, that mm-hmm. you're in that juxtaposition of like at a really fun, like cultural crossroads where you can relate to and interact and share, you know, material culture with so many different people, but like still, because you're at that crossroads, right? Especially with the Bighorn Basin, that's access to the Great Basin, like across into the Salt Lake River, or Salt Lake, but also into Idaho and then up north into Saskatchewan. Like that's yeah. awesome.
And in terms of archaeology, it makes for a Crow country to be like pretty dynamic, because we have all that like Great Basin like influence with like the Nummik, you know, like the, I don't know if you're a fan of the expansion, the Nummik expansion theory yeah. and all that, but the rock art, the motif is real similar to like stuff there. Then we have, of course, I'm from like the Mecca of George Frizen, you know, and like where Frizen did all his stuff, and whether you like him or love him, like that's, he's influenced all of archaeology, especially in the plains. So I deal with a lot of Frizen disciples, you know.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
I tease Bob Kelly and I called him a prison disciple. And I don't know if he liked that. I said, Wyoming.
I bet he did. Bob and George got along super well. Yeah, and I remember I mean, because I got my, you know, master's from University of Wyoming, and yeah. I did work out in the Bighorn. And like George, when he was still alive, he would talk about, because his ranch was in that area. And he had these memories of being scared to death when I think he was like a teenager or something, because he was out hunting in the Bighorns in like the 20s. And out of nowhere, he said like ghosts, a bunch of Crow guys on horses just kind of showed up also out hunting. And he had this like really weird, like he was just so scared that these Crow men just appeared out of the mountains in their camp. And they were just like, you know, just caught him.
He's lucky they didn't take him out. I'm teasing. I just feel like I have a lot of respect for what George Frizen did, but I also am not somebody who's married to any of these ideas, right? So I think just like George, I think there needs to be more people who are willing to challenge what archaeology does and how it does things, and willing to change things and question new things and bring in new ideas. And I think for the time, George kind of shook things up because of the way he had done things, and he was so like kind of good old boy, you know? So I think it freaked like the standard archaeology approach. He was just kind of like a homegrown guy. And I'm just waiting for the new George, whoever the new George is, you know, we'll read his book.
Right. Well, I think that's more like native folks, right? Because like George, like you said, the rancher archaeologist, right? Like he went, grew up, he was a rancher out there in Wyoming for so long, went to World War II in the Navy, came back, used the GI Bill, and was tired of having these East Coast academics in archaeology tell him what's what, went, got an archaeology degree. And as someone who was familiar through that ranching landscape to know the record, you know, he was, like you said, shook things up. But that was, you know, we love George, and he did so much to bring Rocky Mountain, Wyoming archaeology to the forefront, remind people that bison are important to Plains Indians. Like the fact that was revolutionary to some people was wild, right? You know, another one of those things of like, why was this revolutionary? But, you know, it's been a while, and science is a self-improving process. And you're part of that generation of folks that are, you know, continuing the work by having science reevaluate itself and making stronger and better analyses and understanding the human past. So like, I don't think it's anything to be ashamed of. It's just how the field's supposed to be.
Yeah, you're right. It's supposed to be that way. I don't consider myself an archaeologist though, which is weird because that's my thing. But I think I'm a preservationist that just uses whatever is available to do its job, you know?
Yeah. In the broader field of cultural heritage, you're definitely in there and overlapping with those archaeology books.
I like a good field sketch. Like if I see someone do some good field notes and like a good sketch, like a stone feature sketch, drawing, man, that's dope.
That's always a talent. Absolutely. All right. On that note, we're going to go ahead and wrap up the segment, and we'll be right back with Aaron for segment two. And we're back. And so kind of tying back to one of those closing statements in segment one, talking about like, you know, not even thinking of yourself necessarily as an archaeologist and as a tribal historic preservation, or TIPO for short. I hear some people say THIPO.
Yeah.
Maybe that's an older verbiage, but like, I don't know. That just sounds weird to me. You know, how do you approach being a TIPO? And is it strictly just doing like the Section 106 compliance? Are you also the NAGPRA officer, or is that a separate person?
No, I'm the NAGPRA guy. I have kind of a NAGPRA coordinator, kind of a tech. So if you take the premise of a Section 106 reviewer, I have a NAGPRA reviewer. It's the same person. So I'm the preservation officer, the NAGPRA person, and I also run tourism. So the tribal tourism department. So,
okay, that's a new hat.
Yeah, it's different than my beliefs, you know, because I'm not one of these. I'm not a romantic guy, and I don't think we're for sale. And I think our attention should be Indian people, and that's who our audience should be. And it's not a diss on anybody else. It just has to do with the rate in which we're losing culture, where our attention should go, you know. So kind of the way I've taken the tourism thing is that somebody who believes that should be in charge, because we can kind of vet how people see us, you know, and how they perceive us. And so there's that. But in terms of preservation, dude, I'll be honest, man, it's the hardest job I've ever had. And that includes like labor jobs and construction and cowboy stuff and like everything, man, landscaping. It's the most mentally taxing job I've ever had. And even me, myself, and I'm not saying this to brag, but on paper, I'm the most prepared person to come into the job. I have a master's degree in this very field, and I published in this field, and I taught in tribal historic preservation at Sayers Kootenai College for 4 years. And I've worked for different archaeological firms and did all that. So on paper, I'm like, this is catered to Aaron. But when I got there, it was like, oh man, we're not like teaching people anything. Like, it's like impossible to learn how to do this job. It's so hard, and it's so underpaid and understaffed and underappreciated. And I'm not saying those things as like everybody says that. Like, I'm serious. Like, this job is underappreciated by everybody, like federal agencies, tribal people. Even people in our field, they don't see preservation as like part of the field. Our preservation officers, that we're kind of like a subset, we're in like, oh, they're regulated. They do regulatory So like our contribution to archaeology and is not seen as a positive contribution, but knowing what I know now and having done the job for 5 years, it's like, that's all it is, man. It's just preserving as much as we can, one tiny puzzle piece at a time. And until you do it for any length of time, you might not see the benefit directly, but I'm starting to see those things, you know. It's tough, man. Like, I'm a professional arguer. That's what I do, is argue. And any preservation officer, especially out here in the plains, because like a lot of places, preservation is not typically seen by the conservative side of our politics. So there's a lot of conflict, you know. So if you're not comfortable, if you're uncomfortable with the awkward, then this job ain't meant for you. It's full of awkward, full of being uncomfortable, but it's like you still got to push forward all the time, come up with clever ways to do our work. So,
yeah. And even just like being a TIPO representing your nation in what's supposed to be a government to government relationship with the United States, right? Like, you are supposed to be the equivalent of a state ship or a state archaeologist. You're supposed to be the equivalent of one of the undersecretaries of BOR, Army Corps, whatever.
Yeah.
But then it's also managing, especially on the plains, the tribal politics, like managing, you know, having to also interact with other tribes and, you know, in these as well. So, I mean, like, yeah, I can totally understand when you say you have to be comfortable being uncomfortable in that job, because
that's all it is. I mean, that's all it is. And what I've noticed is if our job as preservation officers is just to review federal undertakings, that's one thing, right? But what's happened and just what the culture of preservation work has created is that preservation officers, for a lot of people, and I've talked to a lot of tribes, so I hear similar things, and I'm speaking at, I don't want to paint everybody like this, but we've kind of become official, unofficial, like cultural advisors to our governments, right? So not only do we have to understand the laws that we regulate and we hold people in compliance to, we have to understand our culture. And like, people don't get that. Like, people either think preservation officers are these old wise men, usually men, right? These old wise people. It's kind of like a litigator, but really you're like, your job is to figure out that middle ground. And so you have to really have a strong command of your cultural beliefs and in practice and how to place that into regulatory work. That's tough to do because you're teaching the unteachable usually. And the federal government isn't always very patient and understanding of things, but also your own people can be pretty testy, you know. And like, I love my people, and that's the whole reason for doing the job. But sometimes it is hard to explain my work and justify my existence to my own people. It's, the thought is that I shouldn't have to do that, but I'm sure every preservation officer goes through, you know, those pitfalls, you know, those speed bumps and roadblocks. So,
yeah, and I've never understood that, right? Like, I don't think you can find a single tribal council person that ever ran on a platform of F culture. Like, you know, they always have to have a cultural bit. Like, I'm cultural or culture. Yeah. But then TIPOs or cultural offices and language programs are usually like one of the most underfunded, understaffed entity within a tribe. And it's like, well, what defines you as a people if not your culture and history? Like, what separates your nation, not you as in, you know, the Crow, but like the conceptual, like, what separates a tribe if not your cultural background and history? And isn't it important that you should have like a TIPO and a NACPRA officer are some of the only federally and state obligated mechanisms to project a tribe's sovereignty back into homelands? And it's just wild to me that tribes don't really understand the purpose of that.
No, they don't. And if they do, what I've noticed with tribes, especially like neighboring tribes, us preservation officers are either overused by our tribes or we're like completely ignored. Like, people don't even know what we do or where our offices are or anything. And then, and for some tribes, we're used for like everything. You just use them for everything. And then there's also times where they want to use us as kind of like the pit bull, right? The guard dog against farming and ranching or mining or whatever. And a lot of times those would have combated some of those issues has to happen early on in the consultation. It can't happen the day before it's going to happen, you know? And so they're like, you get out there and you stop them from doing this. And I'm like, with what authority? Like, really, like what we had in some cases, we could have had this amount of time to do that. So I think there's like a misunderstanding of what it is we do and how we do our job. So this is another thing though, too, is we're not a cultural department. Like, I feel like people think most TIPOs should be like culture committees. And I think there's connection. They work together. But I don't think there should ever be a time where I'm dictating culture and dictating who and can't do things. And I should never have the keys to the kingdom like that. Culture belongs to people and it always should belong to people. And I shouldn't sit there and have say on those kinds of things. And that's where the NAGPRA thing can get kind of sketchy, because we do have a lot of say in where certain items can go and things, and that authority is all sometimes it's not fair. I don't know what I'm trying to say, but it's like our offices can carry some weight, right?
Right.
And you have to be self-aware of where that weight is thrown and who it's used against. And I try to be aware that I'm not doing anything against my own people, you know, like my job is to protect sites on federal undertaking, protect culture in federal undertakings. My job is never to combat my own people. That's not my place.
Absolutely. That's well said. And kind of like transitioning, like completely going into a different tour here. I want to bring up two things. Like one, when we were talking about tribal relations and being tourism, how excited are you for the 150th anniversary of Battle?
I'm not excited at all. I had a meeting today that didn't go as well as it could have went. And it really just has to come down to maybe we can talk through a problem here. My issue is that the Battle of the Little Bighorn is a national park, but it sits right in the middle of the Crow Reservation. Am I crazy to think that their first phone call to tribes should be us? Is that wild to think?
No, that seems like incredibly reasonable since it's going to be like roads going through your reservation with that amount of people is going to be affecting the Crow people directly, whether they like it or not. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you would think your superintendent there would be reaching out to tribal council or whatever federal agency should be talking to Crow agency.
Yeah, so that's my thought is like, hey, man, I can see the battlefield from my office. We're neighbors. So you're not just obligated to talk to us under consultation. You're obligated to talk to us because we're neighbors, right? You come to work every day through Crow land. So it's a courtesy. It's just good neighboring practices to say, hey, there's a change in this. Let's call Aaron at the preservation office and make sure he knows, you know, like, so, but there's this culture there that they lump us in with the other tribes. And I get that. Like, I totally understand that part of it, especially when it's the tribes that participated in the battle. That's fine. That's like equal footing. But it's also still just a national park that's subject to the federal laws that every other federal agency is subject to. So my thought is always like, hey, you're within the boundaries of the Crow Reservation. Like, you should talk to us first. Like, it should start here. The conversation should start here. But maybe I'm wrong, man. I don't know. I just see, maybe it's naive, but I don't know.
No, I'm with you on that. They're also missing the point that there could be, and I might be overstepping, right? As the nation who is hosting it, ostensibly, right? Like, they are within your boundary. There is also that obligation at times of like, you guys will be hosting tribal leaders from like at least seven different nations. Mm-hmm. And so there is also that impetus that if you guys being good hosts and being welcoming to these folks and like being able to receive them properly, and that there is a tribal etiquette that has to take place. And if the federal government is not allowing you agendas, times, it makes Crow Nation look reactive rather than being proactive and welcoming guests for, you know, it is a historic moment in which, you know, is very much encapsulated by like the American spirit. Like Little Bighorn is just such a big part of that. And so, yeah, I mean, to me, that seems incredibly reasonable what you're saying. Like, the Fed should be making sure you guys are up to date so you can be proactive and accommodating to the tribal nations that are going, but also the thousands of Americans that will also be there, if not tens of thousands, traveling into, I guess, Billings, where's the nearest airport's Billings, right?
Billings, yeah. Sheridan has a small airport, but I don't know if it's, I really don't know what their flights look like. And yeah, I mean, I totally 100% admit that my communication skills can be better, but I think that's just a symptom of the preservation world. Is like, there's just times I just don't want to talk on the phone. Like, I just don't. Any given day, I'm going to receive anywhere from 50 to 100 emails on any given day. I'm getting anywhere from 300 to 500 emails in a week, like, which for every 10 emails, every 20 emails, you're getting on a Teams call. And for every 3 emails sent, I'm getting a follow-up phone call from an agency. So people don't realize, like, when I miss your call, it's not, I'm not trying to be disrespectful or diss on you. It's that sometimes I just miss it. But the other times it's like, man, I've been on the phone all day. Like, I'm going to try to remember to call you back tomorrow, you know? So right. It's tough, man. And it's really tested my people skills. It's tested my communication skills. It's made me better at being real forward about how I think and feel about things. I've really polished that, like being able to just say things that make everybody uncomfortable, but for the sake of time, like sometimes those things need to be said so we can get right to the work in fixing it. I've never said anything that I wasn't willing to fix. So if I'm calling out a problem, I'm calling it out with the assumption that we're going to try to fix it. I'm not just saying it. I'm not bitching the bitch, you know, like I'm there to do the work too. And it's tough, man. It should be a documentary on preservation officers. Like
that, yeah, to actually know what you guys do, 100%. Like, yeah,
man, it's crazy. We do more than shippos. I'll tell you that right now. We do more than shippos. Like, I'm not afraid to say that. So
yeah, because shippos have like a whole office. You have your shippo, deputy shippo, GIS specialist. You know, like they get like, you know, at least 10 people at a shippo office. You know, and you guys, it's like, yeah, like you're also doing tourism. I imagine you're also part-time janitor. Like you wear way.
Oh, yeah. We do our own janitor stuff and our custodial work, our own maintenance. For the most part, the basic maintenance is us. And then, yeah, we're our own landscapers. And yeah, man, I think I counted 45 agencies and like contractors that I work with fairly regular. So like between now, if I say BLM, I'm talking about like 7 different BLM offices that I work with in Wyoming and Montana, North Dakota, and, you know, anywhere. So it's Forest Service, National Park. We have a park that borders the reservation. One side of it is the res, the other isn't. And then we have one in the middle of the res. So I'm with NPS quite a bit, and then our association with all the federal lands in Montana and Wyoming and Northern Colorado. And then there's all the NAGPRA stuff, which is like that's not even the federal undertakings. That's just every small little museum wanting to know if they can display a diorama from 1965. And we have to give that the same amount of attention we give everything else. And we try. Maybe that's part of our downfall, but we really do try in our office to give every undertaking the same amount of attention, you know? So I don't know. We're working on ourselves. Pray for us.
All the time, man. Sounds good. Well, I think on that note, so I do want to highlight, you're also the host of a podcast. What's the name of that podcast?
Tribal Research Specialist.
Tribal Research Specialist. Excellent. And now where can they find your podcast?
I think in anywhere, Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts. There's even some episodes on YouTube. Yeah, man. Like, it's everywhere. Spotify is like where I think most people kind of go, or are Apple Podcasts. So
excellent. And then there's a handle for that, right? Or is it just your personal Instagram?
Sure. It's not my personal Instagram. I have a personal Instagram, and then I have that one. I have 2 Instagrams.
Oh, good. So your work Instagram is just Indigenous Archaeology. That's nuts. You're able to claim that. Like, I was like, wait a minute. That's when I saw it was you. I was like, how does Aaron have that? Like, I thought that would have got snatched up by like Joe Watkins or someone like
two.
Like,
so too. I just typed it in. There was no other one. And I really did it just as a way to, when I was teaching, it was like kind of just a fun thing to do. Like, and I took a break from it for a long time, you know, but
Excellent. Well, Aaron, it was awesome to have you on the podcast. It was great to actually like see your face for the first time, because it is hard. Like you are incredibly busy and you're serving your people. And no, it's been great to chat with you over the past couple of years. Would love to have you when you have space to see you again, or to see you actually. Sure. I need to visit Montana at some point. I will have to talk to you actually, because we have this goddamn horse named Comanche that survived the Battle of Little Bighorn. How it ended up in Kansas is its own thing. Anyways, we're trying to get rid of this horse, or not get rid of it, but it might be going to Little Bighorn for a temporary exhibit at some point. And that'd be a great opportunity to see my old house at the superintendent's house at Crow Agency. And also yeah, hang out with you for a little bit.
Yeah, come over. We'll show you some, take you to some sites or something, or burn you in the sweat or something. I don't know.
Dude, crow sweats are hot. I've done one. I'm just like, man. Like that one roasted me, but it was a good time. I love that reservation. It is, you guys are absolutely on one of the most prettiest landscapes, and to be on ancestral homelands is also like, I'm incredibly envious of Crow and others that you guys are on ancestral homelands in such a pretty place. Great hunting, but damn, does it get humid in the summer up there.
It's crazy. We can be 30 below in the winter and 104 in the summer. It's like, that's, I don't know, man. It's crazy. But we got good water, we got trees, we got mountains, we got plains, we got everything. So
it's a good time.
Come and check it out.
Absolutely. And with that, we'll catch you guys next time. The next episode, we're going to be having Chris Nicholson, who is the director of TDAR, talking about his digital curation and what TDAR does for the field. So catch you guys next time. Thank you for listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. You can follow me on Instagram at Pawnee_archaeologist, and you can also email me at greatplainsarcpodcast@gmail.com. And remember, anybody can love the mountains, but it takes a soul to love the prairie. American author Willa Cather.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.